Hey everyone, and welcome to another edition of Seriously Risky Business. My name's Patrick Gray. In just a moment, we're going to talk with Tom Uren about the newsletter he's written for us, the newsletter that he writes every week that you can find at news.risky.biz. But before we chat to him, we just want to say thanks to the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation for supporting Tom's work with us, and also say thanks to Lawfare, who are our partners in crime on all of this. And this week's edition of the newsletter and this podcast are brought to you by Airlock Digital, who make an allow listing solution that's actually usable at scale. So there we go. You can find them at airlockdigital.com. Tom, welcome. Good to see you.
G'day, Pat. How are you?
Good, good. And let's walk through your newsletter now. You've written four kind of like mini features this week, and they're all really interesting. The first one is about your take on the XZ backdoor, the attempted, I suppose it was partially successful backdoor in a component of Linux. And really what you've written up here is that, you know, this is probably going to happen again. May also be in progress in other components of the OS. We just don't know. But the fundamental problem from a security standpoint in trying to stop all of this happening, how did you phrase it? Let me find it. The business model of open source is internet strangers collaborating to achieve a common goal.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's your hot take on all of this. But you've also looked at the some commentary from some open source foundations around this, and they support what you're saying.
Yeah. So the really at heart, the air quotes vulnerability, is that open source software is just random people coming together. And if you're willing to put in the work to be a valuable open source contributor, over time, you'll end up in a position of trust. It's just a matter of time. And so if you're a state actor and you want to do that, does the investment match the payoff that we're going to get? And for some of these projects, it clearly does. And the suspicious behaviors that people identify, and so these two foundations have a list of suspicious patterns, and some of them are what I would call technical, and some of them are what are sort of social engineering indicators. But all the social engineering ones are kind of peripheral. Like, they might apply a bit more pressure to the person you're trying to influence, but they're not the heart of the attack. The heart of the attack is actually doing the work and contributing. And there's, until you become malicious, there's absolutely no difference between a good open source citizen and a state-backed actor. And so the question is, what do you do about that? And both these foundations say that what we really need is the companies that are making money off open source to contribute back to it.
Mm. And I mean, to be fair though, we have seen that. We've seen companies like, you know, IBM was big on open source. Google kicked a bunch of money in for security improvements to things like OpenSSL. Like, we have seen that in the past, but I think, you know, what you seem to be getting at, and I agree, is that it's one thing to fund some work on some of these marquee projects, but you know, you can still erode the security of open source by chipping away at obscure libraries that get, you know, hooked by all sorts of common software. Like, that's what they tried to do with the XE thing. So it's not entirely enough, is it?
Yeah. So the approach some companies have taken is to try and identify the most critical projects and either give them money or assistance. And like, that makes sense. What else are you going to do? You've got to prioritize.
But in this case, you know, you're talking about something that's exploitable via OpenSSH because it's some weird little compression utility buried in the gubbins of Linux, right?
Yeah. And I think the attacker perspective is, let's find projects that are still critical, not in the top 10 or top 50 most critical, but have very few maintainers, because they'll be the ones that could use a bit of help.
I mean, Log4j is a terrific example of a component that not many people would really think about that turned out to be just so important. So when there was a bug in it, it was huge. And I think there is a difference, isn't there, between funding efforts to improve the security engineering of something like Apache, for example. There's a difference between addressing that security risk and addressing this security risk, which is, well, how do we trust the people who are actually authorized to commit the code?
Yeah. So it seems like there's two parts. There's the, how do you protect from the social engineering aspect? And I think really the only way you can protect from that is just have more people involved. Because, you know, you get in just if it's just an individual, for example, and they just don't have the time to review all the code, they trust someone else because they've earned that trust. You know, they might give it a cursory skim, but they're not going to look in depth.
Yeah.
And then there's kind of the technical aspect. Can you figure out once a backdoor is inserted that it has been? And I think people are working on that. I'm skeptical it will ever be a perfect solution. I think people will figure out ways that are, you know, tricky.
Yeah.
So, but I think CISA also in the last week released a post which was lessons from XZutils. And they basically said the same thing, that we need corporates to dedicate more time and money.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, right? Because where companies tend to spend money on open source, it's the bits that they rely on, right? It's the bits that they need to improve themselves for their own commercial ends. And ain't nobody got time to be throwing money and resources at something like an obscure, you know, I guess it's not obscure, but, you know, at a boring component. Well, yeah. but you know what I mean? Like, they're going to throw money at Apache and sort of build features that they can then, you know, marry up to their commercial offerings. So I think it's just, I agree with them, right? But I think it's going to be a hard sell. What do you think?
I think it's very difficult. And I think the more I talk about it, the more it gets clear to me that the people who want to do this, there'll be a lot of projects where there's few maintainers. They're still, to some level, they're important enough to subvert, but not important enough to ever reach the radar of people looking to protect them. Like, what else are you going to do? Like, I think you've got to make that call for people to put more time and effort. And I think, I don't even think that money necessarily helps these kinds of projects. It's the people.
And it's also convincing people who are very good at like secure code, like identifying problems in code and whatever. Like, you know, to do it at that level, it requires a lot of skill, right? And those sort of people tend to be enjoying, you know, working on other things, right? So it's a curly problem. What can we say? Now, the other thing you looked at was the Sisense breach, where they lost a bucket load of keys and whatnot. You know, we spoke about it on the main show, but your take here is interesting because you're really looking at how CISA, which is, you know, a part of the US government's Department of Homeland Security, is trying to help guide a response to this sort of thing. And, you know, you're making the point that, you know, perhaps Sisense underinvested in security and now taxpayers are paying to try to mitigate this. And this isn't usually the way it works with government. Now, in no way are you arguing that what CISA is doing here is inappropriate, but you are arguing that it's sort of a little bit different to how this normally works. Like, the EPA doesn't go around and like clean up people's environmental screw-ups for them and not stiff them with a bill. You know what I mean? Like, so normally the idea is you regulate, and when someone does something bad, they're expected to clean it up and pay a fine and whatever. Whereas in this case, it's like, you know, we've got the Department of Homeland Security going, oh, well, let us step in and help you, kind sirs, which is just a bit perverse.
In some sense, it was worse than that, in that Mark Rogers, who is a security researcher, he tweeted a lot about this, and he actually thanked agencies from all over the Five Eyes, US, UK, Canada, New Zealand, and Antarctica.
I noticed mentioned. The Antarctica one he was thrown in there. Yeah, shout out to Antarctica.
Yep. And so it just struck me that that's a lot of people to get involved that you need to sort of hoover into that effort to try and remediate or mitigate the risk. And it's just sort of reminded me of what we spoke about last week, where, you know, at times government agencies are forced to do work because the alternative is kind of unthinkable.
I think there are some differences, though, because when I think about that analogy, right, with the EPA or whatever, I think regulating something like environmental protection, spill containment, whatever, like it's easier, you know, whereas it's very difficult to just, you know, come up, as we all know, it's very difficult to come up with bulletproof security. So I guess allowances are made for things to go sideways a little bit more in security, and it's almost kind of reasonable. But it still is a bit weird. I don't know. I still don't know what I think about this. That's why it's an interesting piece. Well done.
Well, I think it's a spectrum, right?
Yeah.
And so there are definitely breaches that happen where the consequences are huge, but you don't think that the victim organization has necessarily done anything wrong. Like, it's just, you know, a victim of circumstance.
It's one of those things, as we say.
And it's hard to be super definitive in this case because there's no, you know, in-depth breach report. But it very much gives the feeling that Sisense has not done as well as they could. And that particularly came across in the communications afterwards. Like, I was looking at a forum, a Sisense forum, a customer support forum, and there's a whole lot of people basically clamoring for information about what's going on. And Sisense is not publishing a post about it, at least at that point. It was referring everyone to an email address.
Their comms on this, I mean, I didn't look at it super deeply, right? Because I've been busy with all manner of things, right? But I did read about it, you know, read the articles and whatever, and it wasn't even clear to me whether or not this information had been stolen or was merely exposed. If you read Sisense's communications on it, it just wasn't clear.
Right,
Whereas then you look at Krebs on Securities reporting, you know, Brian Krebs writing pieces, talking to sources where they're like, yeah, attackers got the lot. And you just sort of think, well, that's not good comms. You know what I mean? If what's being reported and what you're saying don't match completely. So it does feel like there was a bit of arse covering going on there.
Yeah. It feels like smoke. Like, you know,
circling the wagons, you know, smokescreen. Let's go with all of them.
You know, a tweet that said, you know, we've had a problem. We ask you to reset all your credentials, like all of them. But security is our top priority.
Yes. we take the security of our customers' information very seriously.
If it was your top priority, you would actually tell us what was going on. So that doesn't seem right.
Now, another thing you wrote about, you know, we've spent a lot of time on this program and all of the Risky Biz universe, Risky Biz Extended Universe and Risky Biz Core podcasts talking about how Microsoft sucks when it comes to security and have made a bunch of really terrible decisions. It feels like since the release of the Cyber Safety Review Board's report into that, you know, Chinese hack against the State Department, the tone of media coverage has kind of changed a bit, right? It's become a lot more critical. And a great example of that is a piece that Eric Geller, he used to work at Politico, now he's filing for Wired. I'm not sure if he's on staff or he's freelance, but he wrote a piece about Microsoft in which he really took them to task. It's an excellent piece. But you also noticed something in that piece, that CISA is currently working on creating a new greenfield architecture. And this is very interesting because there's, you know, one of the things CISA says is, oh, there's no Active Directory in this new architecture. And I thought, you know, the details are scant, but I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if this architecture was designed to minimize reliance on Microsoft products and services? I have a feeling it's probably not. But the idea that there is a group of people trying to spin up a new standard operating environment for US government strikes me as an opportunity to address some of these issues. I don't know. I just find that whole concept really interesting. I think it's good that the government is doing something like this.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting as well. So the main thrust of Eric's piece is that the government is dependent on Microsoft for a number of reasons. And one of those reasons, and maybe, I don't know if it's the most important one, is that the, you know, all government agencies are basically used to Microsoft software, and it's extremely hard to switch away from them. And this sort of greenfield architecture seems like an opportunity to at least experiment and then wean themselves off that dependency. So when it came to, I think it was called the JEDI contract, which was a very big contract for cloud or cloud services, part of the contract was that the companies that provide it have to build, I think they called them off-ramps, the ability to be able to switch to other cloud providers. And I think that kind of portability is a very useful thing to be able to say to a company or to exhibit to a company that we have genuine options. And if you're not providing what we need, we can move somewhere else.
I mean, I'm a skeptic there, right? Because I think I said recently on one of the podcasts that, you know, 50% of the world's economy is run in Excel. You know, Excel's like a developer suite for people who aren't developers. You know, it's a really powerful bit of software. And it's one thing to say, oh, well, you know, we'll make the file formats completely transparent and open, but ain't nobody else making something equivalent, you know. In some ways, they're kind of stuck, but I think you can, I think the, I mean, I wrote about this myself when you were on leave. I filled in for you and wrote about this. And I think maybe some of those, you know, app portability, not just, you know, not just portable documents, but portable apps. Like, so you could run Excel on AWS or, you know, whatever. I don't know. I mean, it's, I'm just saying this is going to be a really curly one. This is a curly problem to solve. This Microsoft dependency thing, I think having an off-ramp is one thing, but an off-ramp to where? It's like an off-ramp to a dead end.
I think the way I, like, I don't disagree with you. The way I think about this, though, is that this is a long-term strategic problem.
100%.
So you're not going to solve it.
I'm not sure where it'll go, but like we can't just say, oh, we've got off-ramps baked into the contract, you know, job done. Let's go get a coffee, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think the tendency is to think it's a very difficult problem. We can't do anything about it now, so let's not do anything.
Yeah.
Whereas the answer should be, this is a very long-term strategic problem and we need to start efforts to figure something out.
Yeah. I think having a team of people doing Greenfield's architecture development is a very good start.
Yeah. Yep. That's basically my takeaway too. I think what would be good is if it was explicit that we want options. We don't want you know, having something more secure, and I think part of the point was to have you know, air quotes, zero trust.
Yep.
Inbuilt into that architecture. We want that, but we also want options that don't make us reliant on any particular vendor.
Yeah, Microsoft, the less than zero trust vendor, I think is could be a catchy line, couldn't it? Now, you've also looked at some testimony that General Tim Hogg gave to the Senate Armed Services Committee. He's, of course, the head of U.S. Cyber Command. And he's also, it's dual hat, right? He's head of NSA as well.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what did he say?
What I really liked about this is that it's a really nice summation of the way that Cyber Command looks at the world. So this was wearing his Cyber Command head hat. So, you know, the
head
PRC.
Hat. I love it.
The PRC.
Not his elbow hat.
The PRC, you know, they've used these words before, pacing challenge, and employs the world's largest cyber operations workforce. And the main priority for Cyber Command was defending US critical infrastructure. Russia, still an acute threat, but they've been diverted by the war in Ukraine. Like, so they've got just less time to do other things. But interestingly, I thought he said that they think it is most likely that they will interfere with elections in the US and Europe this year. So
buckle up. That's going to be fun, right?
Yeah, that's right. So that's the first time I'd noticed them saying most likely.
Well, I mean, you'd suggest when someone like Tim Hogg says that he's basing it on something other than vibes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an assessment rather than a...
Yeah.
Than a,
rather than a feel opinion. Yeah.
Yep. And then Iran, what was interesting here is that they'd said they'd done a lot of work in the Middle East to protect, especially since the start of the Israel-Hamas war. And then North Korea, he also talked about. And what came across to me is that they're like a tertiary concern compared to the other three there.
Well, because they're mostly stealing made-up internet money from idiots.
Yeah, now it was exactly. I think, you know, what are we going to do about that? Nothing. The problem is that that's used to fund nuclear weapons proliferation.
I mean, look, I hear people making that argument all the time, Tom. And when you look at the crypto theft, okay, sure, it's a lot of money, but as a proportion of North Korea's GDP, it ain't actually all that much.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that the feeling I got, and this is just a feeling,
like if you stopped them getting the crypto, it would have absolutely zero impact on their nuclear weapons program. They would take the money from somewhere else, like food for their people. You know what I mean? Like, nuclear weapons are their number one priority. As long as they have a somewhat functioning economy, that program's getting funded. So I am kind of like, as you can tell, right? I'm kind of a little bit, it grates with me that people consistently use that line that it funds nuclear weapons. I mean, we all say it, right? I used to say it. Adam still says it. but it just, I think we got to retire that line.
Yeah, and like, I think that's why I get that feeling from this testimony. It's like, yeah, sure, they get the money. I also think that you're not going to deter North Korea from doing missile things with Cyber Command. And no. So it's, right, we're not the best, we don't have the best capabilities to stop North Korea nuclear proliferation. So, you know, yeah, we're aware that it happens and maybe we'll do something. That was the feeling I got. Yeah. Again, this is unclassified testimony. And then, you know, lots of hunt forward operations. He talks about releasing more than 90 malware samples. And it says these frustrate the military and intelligence operations of authoritarian regimes. And nice. that just felt like, yes, I'm really happy about this.
Yeah. I'm frustrating people. Yeah. I'm making them rub their temples. Job well done.
Yeah.
All right, mate, there's a bunch of shorts and reasons to be cheerful and all sorts of other stuff in this week's newsletter. People, again, can find it at news.risky.biz and subscribe to it so it hits their mailbox every week. But, mate, that is all we have time for. Great to chat to you as always. You'll be recording this interview with Adam next week because I'm on leave. So enjoy that, and I'll catch you in a couple of weeks.
Great. Thanks, Matt.